So we are in chapter 3, the eternal and the individual. And this is the paragraph beginning in our practical dealings with life. Towards the end of the paragraph, about 3 pages in. Which is, what page is this in the PDF version, anybody?
PDF version in our practical dealings starts on page 397.
Okay.
Last line of page 397.
Good. So page 397 in our practical dealings. And in this part of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is carrying out his rationale for a Trinitarian notion of reality. We discussed this last time, and Trinitarian notion means that there are 3 coeval realities or self-presentations of the divine, which in themselves and in their interactions constitutes reality for us. These 3 are the absolute, the cosmic, and the individual. Sri Aurobindo has taken pains to explain how these are related to each other, how they are entangled, one may say, in each other, inextricably entangled in each other, and cannot be flattened out to any single reality without losing some of the meaning and purpose of the reality in which we find ourselves. So this is what has happened over time because the experience of separation that we have in our cosmic existence is not a pleasant one. It is the basis of what has been called the ignorance with a capital I or avidya in the Upanishads. This experience is due to the finite nature of our physical selves, self-definition as individuals. Individuals are materially finite. And that provides the sensory definition through which we experience each other. It is a separate reality, each a separate reality. And the universe is extended with each of these finite centers or realities as their centers. Now, naturally, it is known as the ignorance because from this kind of discrete individual reality, it is impossible to fully know any other of these discrete realities. We are in the world of the many, and each of the many can only make sense of others through inference, or through the extension of one's understanding, either by empathy or by reason, by intelligence. Now, there are other and deeper ways by which we may arrive at the commonalities that unite us, or we may even arrive at a sense, intuition of what is the reality of others, the subjective reality of others, through some kind of internal contact. But these are not overtly apparent to us. We sense a kind of internal diffuseness once we look within, so that one may say that though we experience ourselves through our external senses as finite, there is a intuition of being unbounded within. So we can call this reality of the individual an unlimited finite. It's finite, yet the possibilities within it are unlimited. These individuals exist or coexist within a cosmos, which is, on the other hand, something which sprawls indefinitely, seems to be infinite, yet which is bound by laws. So we can use the term a bounded infinite for this cosmos. Hence we can see that both individual and cosmos are different configurations of infinity. They are different self-presentations of infinity. The absolute, on the other hand, is an unbounded infinite. There are no laws that limit it. It perceives its own reality in terms of its own truths, the truths of its own self, and expresses these as real ideas. And this faculty through which it presents itself to itself in terms of real ideas is supermind. So this self-presentation as a bounded real idea, in which a certain kind of discrete appearance produces multiplicity and produces time as a process by which the infinity is deployed as a kind of evolution, an evolution of consciousness, a graded and phased evolution of consciousness in the cosmos and in the individuals who constitute that cosmos. So this forms the interrelated reality of this Trinitarianism. The absolute has presented itself as the cosmos, as a context, and within the cosmos, the possibilities of the cosmos are discreetly again self-presented as individual realities that are in play, that are in interaction with one another, that share a common space and time or cosmos, and are related to each other and to the cosmos. But both these realities, self-presentations, take their meaning from the absolute, which is the unlimited infinite. To flatten the individual, because it feels constrained by its limitedness and its ignorance, subjection to the laws of the cosmos, there has been an attempt to overcome these things by flattening the individual into the absolute. It is as if by losing the separateness, one enters into the undifferentiated whole. But the problem with this is that then the evolutionary meaning of these other self-presentations is completely lost. So what Sri Aurobindo is trying to say here is that it is important for us to realize that these self-presentations are to be experienced for their own realities, for their own purposes, for what they represent to the whole, and that we need to exist in these three kinds of infinities simultaneously. How can we do that? This becomes the big question, and this is entirely the reason why Sri Aurobindo is in search for a kind of cosmic consciousness in which, we can use the term transcendental consciousness, since its laws must exceed the laws of the cosmos, that he discovers the supermind as that faculty that allows or that holds in itself the absolute, the cosmic, and the individual. I think that's where we are. Sri Aurobindo has discussed this and is now coming to talk about our practical relations with each other, with the world, and with the Absolute, and to show how it is necessary to, you know, to give validity to these three in these practical relations as well. So, if there are any comments or questions, we can consider and then move on.
Can you talk about what you meant by, you know, flattening of the individual, as you said, like, of the, you know, what's the context around, like, what it means to, is that a means of, like, you know, compressing the human experience, or, like, kind of trying to explain it in minimal terms? Is that what it is?
By flattening the human, what I meant was that instead of looking at these three dimensions, one may say, because each one of them is a configuration of infinity, and they seem to coexist, but they coexist uneasily. The reason they coexist uneasily is because all this is occurring under the state of being, or the modality of being, of the mind. So the mind cannot hold opposites together. It tries to quickly arrive at exclusive contradictions and hold one to be true and the other to be false. So if the individual is a finite, it highlights that finitude while erasing or abrogating its infinity, its unlimited potential, or its internal diffuseness. Same way, if the cosmic seems to be a bounded infinite, it highlights its infinity and sees the individual to be a contradiction. You know, it's sort of different from it because of this very, you know, opposite of its primary property. Similarly, the Absolute is seen to be different from both of these because it has no limitation. It is an unlimited infinite. So we find that if we take any one of these, we are confronted with something which stands against it as its opposite. At the individual level, we can see very easily why it is an uncomfortable experience to have many different experiences coexisting in the same space and time. So we rub against each other, we don't find harmony, we don't find understanding. And so what is the way out of it? The way out that some schools have taught is to get out of the cosmos entirely. So getting out of the cosmos is actually an entry into this Absolute, which has no context, which is infinite radically, and entering which one loses all definition. So the configuration or disposition of the infinite, which has been given to it by the real idea of supermind, is withdrawn, as it were. And one falls into something which is totally undifferentiated. This undifferentiated totality of the Absolute is a flattening. It's a flattening because all definition is lost. It's in this sense that I use the term flattening. We lose definition, we gain liberation. But at the same time, why did we exist within this tripartite or trinitarian reality? is completely sort of left without meaning.
Explained away.
Yeah, it's either explained away or its meaning is voided. We have no need to exist as a multiplicity within a cosmos. While, as a matter of fact, the whole purpose of configuring such an idea for the infinite, for Brahman, would be that it can multiply itself and know the meaning of time, know the experience of evolution, of growth, in a form in which all its infinite possibilities are self-presented as different entities and put in play with one another. So it is this new possibility of God experience, of God's own experience, which we represent and which we, are. And that is erased in a return to the undifferentiated absolute. And that's, in that sense, a flattening.
Yes. Thank you. Let me just say.
When you said that the Absolute has no context, that part, can you elaborate a little bit? Like, does it not contain all contexts?
Yeah, it contains all contexts, absolutely. It contains all contexts. But because these contexts are within it, it's not bound by any one of them. It is in that sense that it is without any context. It is itself contexted, but it can generate every possibility of context as the truths of its radical infinity. And these can, each one of these can become a cosmos, a condition for the play of the possibilities which are bounded by that context.
Thank you.
So when you say each of these can become a cosmos, like, what does it mean that something is a cosmos there? Like, what are you, is a cosmos, like a cosmos is a context of what, a certain set of rules or a certain configuration in which evolution occurs? Like, what does it mean that something is a cosmos?
Yeah, a cosmos is essentially a real idea. Like, for example, we may say that a certain kind of self-perception of the divine decides to lose itself and find itself over time, right? This real idea is the foundation of a condition of being that will be a exploration. That is a cosmos. It is bound by that particular idea. Similarly, we may have a cosmos which is a vital cosmos. A vital cosmos will mean that there is a real idea there which is the self-presentation of being as force while keeping its intelligence and its substantiality latent. Okay? So what happens is that a certain aspect or a certain range of consciousness is put in front, and the laws of that range of consciousness are what bind it and create the context within which its possibilities are then deployed in discrete fashion to form a cosmos of interplay between these possibilities. A material cosmos. A material cosmos is one in which the density of consciousness that we call matter becomes the self-presentation of the absolute. So that the laws of matter then bind that context. See, because the properties that belong to that self-limitation become the context of that self-presentation.
Uh, So the cosmos is something that's projected right at the root, right from the root of the creation, so to say. Like, you know, a certain kind of cosmos is projected, like what we are experiencing, and then the vital cosmos that you said. So they are like kind of like how a certain play of forces starts out, how a certain exploration starts out.
Exactly. And then from a certain point of view, we are looking at all these things in terms of time. As if at a certain point of time something emerged. But in reality, there is no point of time. Everything coexists all at once. And time can be thought of as a dimension of experience, so that this simultaneous coexistence is experienced in a certain way following that dimension of experience or of being. It is experienced in a temporal fashion, but everything coexists all at once. So we find that every possibility of self-presentation, which would be a cosmos, exists forever. This is in a way something that the mother points out when she talks about her experience of the supramental world. From the viewpoint of our evolutionary creation, it seems as if we arrive at the supramental world at a certain point in the evolution. We are about to arrive, or that's the future of this evolutionary cosmos. But the supramental world, as she declared when she actually experienced it, the first lines of her declaration says that this world exists forever, and I have forever been in this world. Okay? She discovers that, as a matter of fact, it is an eternal world, and her own existence has been eternal in that world. So this kind of a world, or it's a cosmos whose nature or the laws that bind it are different from the laws of our evolutionary cosmos, primarily because ignorance does not exist there. Time may exist there in another form. Time may be an unfoldment out of a intrinsic self-knowledge, which is yet keeping its absolute nature in the background. Okay, so when we are talking, in fact, about these three realities, the absolute, the cosmic, and the individual, and arriving at a state of consciousness in which the three are experienced simultaneously, this is, in fact, the condition of the supermind. And that condition includes time, but of a different nature than time as we experience it. And that is how, you know, each one of these cosmoses coexist, and in the reality of things, they have existed forever, and all the existences within them have existed forever.
Thank you, Delicious.
Can we, this cosmos thing, this, is it also the, you know, the star, the field of relations in ignorance?
Ignorance itself is a cosmos. So the field of relations in ignorance is the cosmos of the ignorance, the avidya cosmos, you may say. Cosmoses may also be nested. In other words, the cosmos of avidya is in fact the evolutionary cosmos, and that contains within it these other cosmoses of matter, life, and mind. While the cosmos of Vidya is also a cosmos with relations, but the relations are of a different nature. And that is, so these are all different forms of interrelations between beings, and the laws that bind them form the cosmos.
So that means the cosmos has that one part, I mean, necessary part is that law which binds it.
Yes. We talk of the law of the ignorance, for example, but we also talk of the law of the knowledge. The law of the knowledge is the experience of oneness. Everything is experienced as the one being, as forms of the one being that may know themselves through certain kinds of self-differentiation through the four forms of knowledge, for example, prajnana, vijnana, prajnana, samjnana, and ajnana. So these forms of knowledge are specialized operations of knowledge by identity in the vidya. So those are that is the nature of the kind of context that forms the cosmos of vidya. Just as the nature of the context that forms the cosmos of vidya is the evolutionary, kind of principle or real idea that emerges out of supermind.
Just as a reference, is there any particular place, which book and which chapter that I can refer to for this cosmos and vidya?
I'll check it out. I'm not sure offhand. But also, I think, I'm not sure, but we may check the glossary of terms and see if some references have been provided. But otherwise, I'll check and see about the cosmos of vidya where he talks about it, and I'll pass it along once I find it.
Yeah, that would be nice. Thank you.
In some places, Sri Aurobindo talks about cosmos in terms of Purusha and Prakriti and their relations. So, Purusha and Prakriti and their relations is another way of speaking about, the being which is the absolute self configured in that particular cosmos. Prakriti would form the context of the laws that form this cosmos. So Prakriti of any particular cosmos is unfolding according to the laws which bind that cosmos, the idea that binds that cosmos, while its Purusha is its unconditioned part which observes it but cannot do much to it, since the cosmic consciousness. So this is the thing about the law of the avidya. So avidya cosmos, if we talk about an avidya cosmos, the avidya prakriti is bound by the law of the avidya cosmos. And hence, within it, any cosmic existence is also bound by those laws. You see, and can't do much about it. So the relations of Purusha and Prakriti are determined by this particular idea which forms the context of that cosmos. If that changes, the relations also change. So the cosmos is sometimes been defined by Sri Aurobindo as different modalities of relationship between Purusha and Prakriti.
So the Purusha and Prakriti, they mean ignorance, right? I mean, avidya.
I mentioned them as Purusha and Prakriti, and yes, that those two terms he uses generally within the avidya. But it also, he takes the way he's talking about this. Actually, he touches on this in the previous chapter we considered also. And also elsewhere in the synthesis of yoga, where he's saying that relations between Ishvara and Shakti in the Vidya are also relations of Purusha and Prakriti. That is Purusha and Prakriti at that level. And there the relations, the law of the relations is different. So there there is, you know, Purusha that can freely configure its prakriti according to the infinity of its creative will. While here it is bound by the law that has already been coded into prakriti, the idea that is already immanent within it. So these different ways of relating, both in vidya and avidya, are the basis of the differences in the cosmos, the ontologies of the cosmos, its state of being, as it were.
Thank you.
Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Okay. In our practical dealings with life, we have to arrive at the same truth. For certain practical ends, we have to say that a thing is good or bad, beautiful or ugly, just or unjust, and act upon that statement. But if we limit ourselves by it, we do not get at real knowledge. The law of contradictions here is only valid insofar as two different and opposite statements cannot be true of the same thing at the same time, in the same field, in the same respect, from the same point of view, and for the same practical purpose. A great war, destruction, or violent, all-upheaving revolution, for example, may present itself to us as an evil, a virulent and catastrophic disorder, and it is so in certain respects, results, ways of looking at it. But from others, it may be a great good, since it rapidly clears the field for a new good or a more satisfying order. No man is simply good or simply bad. Every man is a mixture of contraries. Even we find these contraries often inextricably mixed up in a single feeling, a single action. All kinds of conflicting qualities, powers, values meet together and run into each other to make up our action, life, nature. We can only understand entirely if we get to some sense of the absolute and yet look at its workings in all the relativities which are being manifested. Look not only at each by itself, but each in relation to all and to that which exceeds and reconciles them all. In fact, we can only know by getting to the divine view and purpose in things, and not merely looking at our own, though our own limited human view and momentary purpose have their validity in the cadre of the all. For behind all relativities, there is this absolute, which gives them their being and their justification. No particular act or arrangement in the world is by itself absolute justice. But there is behind all acts and arrangements something absolute which we call justice, which expresses itself through their relativities, and which we would realize if our view and knowledge were comprehensive instead of being as they are, partial, superficial, limited to a few ostensible facts and appearances. So to there is an absolute good and an absolute beauty, but we can only get a glimpse of it if we embrace all things impartially and get beyond their appearances to some sense of that which, between them, all and each are by their complex terms trying to state and work out, not an indeterminate, for the indeterminate being only the original stuff or perhaps the packed condition of determinations would explain by itself nothing at all, but the Absolute. We can indeed follow the opposite method of breaking up all things and refusing to look at them as a whole and in relation to that which justifies them, and so create an intellectual conception of absolute evil, absolute injustice, the absolute hideousness, painfulness, triviality, vulgarity, or vanity of all things. But that is to pursue to its extreme the method of the ignorance, whose view is based upon division. We cannot rightly so deal with the divine workings, because the absolute expresses itself through relativities, the secret of which we find it difficult to fathom, because to our limited view, everything appears to be purposeless play of oppositions and negatives or a mass of contradictions. We cannot conclude that our first limited view is right, or that all is a vain delusion of the mind and has no reality. Nor can we solve all by an original, unreconciled contradiction, which is to explain all the rest. The human reason is wrong in attaching a separate and definitive value to each contradiction by itself, or getting rid of one by altogether denying the other. But it is right in refusing to accept as final and as the last word the coupling of contradictions which have in no way been reconciled together and have not found their source and significance in something beyond their opposition.
So in this long paragraph, actually what Sri Aurobindo is driving at in these last few paragraphs is also a invitation to a more complex perception of reality. Because though we do not dwell in supermind, where one could actually see these three at the same time, could experience the Absolute having become the cosmos and become the individuals within it, all the individuals within it, he is inviting us to extend the most subtle and higher properties of our mind to approximate to that vision. And so here he is pointing to perhaps the most difficult aspect of that, which is what he says are practical dealings. Because in practical dealings, we find that we most quickly find ourselves confronted by decisions having to do with right and wrong. And he picks on the three major godheads, as they were, the ones that, the primary properties of the divine, as it were, that Plato talks about as the primary ideas, truth, beauty, and goodness, and the same with the Vedic tradition, which talks about Satyam, Shivam, and Sundaram, looks at as the kind of criteria of justice, beauty, and good. These are constantly decisions that we are having to make, or judgments that we are having to make with regard to our practical choices in the world. So this being confronted by this, and that the Vedas are beginning their kind of layout by talking about these battles between the Devas and the Asuras. So this contradiction, which we find all the time, and which, as he has pointed out, is primarily a property of the mind. It's held in place by the mind and experienced also by the mind. creates for us what seems to be a much more sharply contrasted world, a world of light and shadow, you know, that kind of a world. Yet, this appearance is an appearance of the One. And every entity in it is really the entirety of the One that is self-presented with certain properties that form its front, as it were, that seem to be the only properties that are deployed for interaction at a certain time. And so from a practical point of view, it is impossible to get away from this need to choose. But at the same time, one has to see through that appearance and realize that every reality that confronts us in the world of the many is nothing other than the entire cosmos compressed into one, and the entire absolute compressed into and immanent in that one. So this is the view towards which he invites us over here. He's saying that there are a variety of ways he's pointing to that, talking about relativity of values as one, that if there is something that is perceived as bad, it is perceived as bad from a certain point of view. There may be other points of view in which that same bad is good. Then he talks about the criteria of time and place. You know, so he goes through all those various conditions that must be simultaneously satisfied for contradiction to be real. See? And here he's saying it is valid only insofar as two different and opposite statements cannot be true of the same thing at the same time, in the same field, in the same respect, from the same point of view, and for the same practical purpose. So we see also that in terms of time, that which is good today turns bad tomorrow. And the reason is that our whole notion of good and bad is proceeding in time from this evolutionary perspective of the emergence of consciousness. And so that which facilitates that at a certain time is good. And later that same thing may become a impeding factor because its need is no longer felt. It becomes the god of the past who turns into the demon of the present. So this is the way in which, you know, even we find that the term asura has got two etymologies. One is, if we think about sura as God, asura is the negative of God, the contradiction of God. But asu, is there's another even more original etymology in which asu means power or strength. And an asura is one who possesses strength. And this is the, you know, the viewpoint from which Sri Aurobindo has talked about in the Durga Stotra, saying that give us the strength of the asura. You know, then we also find that related traditions to the Vedic, like for example the Zoroastrian, have looked at the asura, as in that case ahura, as the divine. So we find that these terms also have varied valencies, one may say. An asura is transformable. An asura is not necessarily always a being who is anti-divine. An asura may represent a certain kind of potency of expression that under the right conditions becomes a divine instrument and power. So this is how, because it is nothing but the divine that has become all things. this invitation also has practical results because it enhances our own power. Not only are we in a position to see things not fully as black and white, but also as temporary fronts of certain holes. We also develop the power because of the enhanced perception to be able to act on these contradictions and make them less contradictory. Our own power of transforming the world is enhanced by as we develop a more holistic understanding of the forces that we are surrounded by. So this is how he's looking at this particular, very difficult issue. And here again, he's pointing out very clearly that it is not overcome by just wishing away the contradictions, by acting as if, everything is the absolute alone. It has to accept whatever is being presented and at the same time be able to see that that is not itself an absolute, but a self-presentation of the absolute. See, this is, I think, the very cogent point that he's making. And so the differences or contradictions that face us are a process in working out the evolution of the One. And if we look at it from that point of view, we see the necessity of being able to work out these differences to arrive at complex unity. And that is the evolutionary drive of the divine in contradictions.
Debashish, there was a quote that I never really understood of Sri Aurobindo, something like Napoleon, people see Napoleon as a despot, but I saw God striding through Europe. Does that ring a bell? But it seems to talk to this part of the Asura being an instrument of the divine.
Yeah, absolutely. You're very right. There is exactly that aphorism, and that's where it's almost like another statement of what he says here. A great war, destruction, a violent, all-upheaving revolution, for example, may present itself to us as an evil, a virulent and catastrophic disorder. And it is so in certain respects, results, ways of looking at it. But from others, it may be a great good, since it rapidly clears the field for a new good or a more satisfying order. So it's similar to that depending on the viewpoint from which you're looking, you see the hand of God even in what appears to be the opposite of the just, the true, and the beautiful.
Thank you.
In this context, wasn't also there a poem which where Sri Aurobindo has a very bright perspective of Napoleon, not just as an effect of Asuric power, but actually seeing him as somebody like a
Vibhuti
or something?
Yeah, perhaps I have to check whether he has a poem on Napoleon. In several of his writings also he considered Napoleon to be a Vibhuti. And in fact, others, even Vivekananda, had considered Napoleon to be a Vibhuti. In fact, he considered him to be an avatar of Kartikeya, the god of war. So this is very true. What exactly is the perception of something? it may have something, you know, anti-divine in it. Like he has a poem on Hitler who makes a nice contrast to this very same statement. And that poem is called The Dwarf Napoleon. In other words, he contrasts him with Napoleon. And this dwarf, term is used to point to his qualities and his nature in comparison with Napoleon. So essentially what that means is that, you know, whatever the values we give to things can look very different once the mind's preferences of seeing things in black and white is subtilized, is made to remove its arrogance. And then if we start seeing things in the true light, they actually present themselves much more holistically.
I guess probably that dwarf or Napoleon, there itself, maybe he praised Napoleon as he was, and then contrasted.
Yeah, probably, yes.
Something like that.
Yeah, so. Probably, yes.
Couldn't it even mean that when these states of war that are so evil actually have the effect of applying humility to some very arrogant mental preferences?
Yeah, that is also true. That is very true. We actually, through our conflicts, we are enlarged. And in that sense, it serves that good, because it's really out of the ignorance that we are growing. And in that growth, the problems of the ego, which keep us separate and narrow, are forced to acknowledge larger realities. What seems to be opposite ends up becoming a kind of a component in a larger whole. So there is this is the way by which, you know, the whole notion of synthesis is occurring. And that kind of process is not something that can be stopped, and it should not be stopped. This is the reason why Heraclitus talked about war being the parent of all things. What he meant by war was essentially this, that fact that what appear to be contradictions are constantly clashing, but once they come into confrontation with one another, if they embrace each other, that there is a evolution that takes place. That's where it's the parent, which leads to a greater good.
In fact, for our the Hindu traditions, the Gita, the Mahabharata, Kurukshetra is this battlefield being the the evolutionary process of dharma growing.
Yeah. That's why it talks about, that starts by talking about the battlefield as the field of dharma.
Joanna, sorry, was there a question?
No, just a comment that, that life itself is that way, is a battlefield, right? Like, it has to grow by...
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly what he's saying. Life itself is that battlefield, that it's a battlefield exactly because we are faced with contradictions all the time. And yet that evolution is not an evolution that is, kind of doomed to remain one where we are constantly trying to erase, eradicate, annihilate opposites. But one in which we are growing in consciousness to actually find points of synthesis and points of, of oneness, of common context and of the self presentation of the one.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Okay. We cannot either effect a reconciliation or explanation of the original contradictions of existence by taking refuge in our concept of time. Time, as we know or conceive it, is only our means of realizing things in succession. It is a condition and cause of conditions, varies on different planes of existence, varies even for beings on one and the same plane. That is to say, it is not an absolute and cannot explain the primary relations of the absolute. They work themselves out in detail by time and seem to our mental and vital being to be determined by it. But that seeming does not carry us back to their sources and principles. We make the distinction of conditioned and unconditioned, and we imagine that the unconditioned became conditioned, the infinite became finite at some date in time, and may cease to be finite at some other date in time, because it so appears to us in details, particulars, or with regard to this or that system of things. But if we look at existence as a whole, we see that the infinite and finite coexist and exist in and by each other. Even if our universe were to disappear and reappear rhythmically in time, as was the old belief, that too would be only a large detail and would not show that at a particular time all condition ceases in the whole range of infinite existence and all being becomes the unconditioned. At another, it again takes on the reality or the appearance of conditions. The first source and the primary relations lie behind our mental divisions of time, in the divine timelessness or else in the indivisible or eternal time, of which our divisions and successions are only figures in a mental experience.
So we touched on this earlier, which is the experience within time of the way in which things emerge or things disappear. And the idea of contradictions as either being overcome or being irrelevant due to time and also to emerge due to time. And what he's pointing out over here is that we have to look beyond time. And time provides a certain, sort of dimension to experience. It's the dimension of unfolding or the dimension of appearing. But these relations are eternal and they coexist. Everything that ever appears in time is already, always, already present. in the divine. And so it is this, you know, totality, this, as he says, this unconditioned, which has become the conditioned, which is the reality we have to seek for an answer to this experience of the world, not a kind of, you know, subjection to time.
Just a comment that it's interesting that even in it was reminding me in like physics, the Big Bang theory, it accepts the singularity, which is basically that kind of infinite. Yet it immediately, you know, assumes that that infinite created this inflated universe and then just left, and in, you know, everything became all of a sudden finite, and has to be finite. I mean, infinite principles are the only principles. It's quite. I mean, that is quite funny. In fact, I mean, as if it's assumed that something created something, which is other than itself, and it quitted immediately.
Interesting, yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
Uh-huh. John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes. There we see that all meats and all principles, all persistent realities of existence, for the finite as a principle of being is as persistent as the infinite, stand in a primary relation to each other in a free, not an exclusive unity of the absolute, and that the way they present themselves to us in a material or a mental world is only a working out of them secondarily, tertiary or yet lower relativities. The absolute has not become the contrary of itself and assumed at a certain date real or unreal relativities of which it was originally incapable, nor has the one become by a miracle the many, nor the unconditioned deviated into the conditioned, nor the unqualitied sprouted out into qualities. These oppositions are only the conveniences of our mental consciousness, our divisions of the indivisible. The things they represent are not fictions, they are realities, but they are not rightly known if they are set in irreconcilable opposition to or separation from each other. For there is no such irreconcilable opposition or separation of them in the all view of the absolute. This is the weakness, not only of our scientific divisions and metaphysical distinctions, but of our exclusive spiritual realizations, which are only exclusive because to arrive at them, we have to start from our limiting and dividing mental consciousness. We have to make the metaphysical distinctions in order to help our intelligence towards a truth which exceeds it, because it is only so that it can escape from the confusions of our first undistinguishing mental view of things. But if we bind ourselves to them to the end, we make chains of what should only have been first helps. We have to make use too of distinct spiritual realizations, which may at first seem contradictory to each other, because as mental beings, it is difficult or impossible for us to seize at once, largely and completely, what is beyond our mentality. But we err if we intellectualize them into soul truths, as when we assert that the impersonal must be the one ultimate realization and the rest creation of Maya, or declare the saguna, the divine in its qualities, to be that, and thrust away the impersonality from our spiritual experience. We have to see that both these realizations of the great spiritual seekers are equally valid in themselves, equally invalid against each other. They are one and the same reality, experienced on two sides, which are both necessary for the full knowledge and experience of each other, and of that which they both are. So it is with the one and the many, the finite and the infinite, the transcendent and the cosmic, the individual and the universal. Each is the other as well as itself, and neither can be entirely known without the other and without exceeding their appearance of contrary oppositions.
So he's rounding up his argument over here about the need for the coexistence of the contradictions, of the so-called contradictions, that each of these self-presentations is necessary and exists, as it were, to put into relation these varieties and their opposites, so that there is a constant growth, a constant infinity in the nature of contradictions is the, you know, kind of unfoldment of an infinity. So this is how the cosmic infinity opens its possibilities. And at the same time, there is a consciousness in which they are reconciled. That consciousness is one that transcends the cosmos. It is that which has become all these things, and not become them at a certain point in time, as he says, but in status of being, which means that it is always already every possibility and opposite and their origin at the same time.
There's a sonnet of Sri Aurobindo in which he talks about this two contradictions or two opposites in a very dramatic way. It's called The Divine Worker.
Uh-huh.
And the stanza says, "No danger can perturb my spirit's calm. My acts are thine. I do thy works and pass." And then he gives the two opposites. "Failure is cradled on thy deathless arm. Victory is thy passage mirrored in fortune's glass."
Beautiful. Yeah, so that is basically it, as he points out so eloquently here also, that each of these is just another self-presentation, and it's necessary for the infinity of being. You know, that he makes that point about personality and impersonality elsewhere also, where he says that impersonality is the very infinity of the Supreme Person. Because if it were not surrounded by this impersonality, it couldn't become, it would be limited by its personality. But it can draw on the infinity of its possibilities out of this impersonality. So that's the nature of manifestation, is to manifest infinity through these self manifested opposites. And we have to experience them in that form and look for the one that has become these appearances.
The genre word that the where you read it from?
What poem?
Yeah.
It's called The Divine Worker.
The Divine Worker. Mm-hmm.
Among the Puranic gods in India, it is Shiva that most powerfully represents this fact of bringing together opposites and transcending them, being, you know, for example, male and female at the same time, being stillness and movement at the same time, being the creator and the destroyer at the same time. And Sri Aurobindo has a beautiful poem, since we are talking about poems, on Shiva that brings this this fact out.
The poem's name is Shiva.
Yeah, if you all don't mind, I can bring the poem in a moment and tell you what it is and maybe even read it. So just give me a moment.
There, Andas. Is it the one that starts with "On the White Summit of Eternity"?
No, it's not that one.
There is a poem called Shiva, the Inconscient Creator.
Do you know? Let me see. It's not the one which goes on the White Summit of Eternity. Let me see.
No, it starts with a face on the cold, dire mountain peaks. Grand and still.
Not even that one.
Mm-hmm.
Not even that one. Actually, I don't think it's called Shiva. I think this is the one. It's called Epiphany. The poem is called Epiphany. The poem is called Epiphany, and it goes, majestic, mild, immortally august, in silence throned, To just and to unjust, one Lord of deep unutterable love, I saw him, Shiva, like a brooding dove, close-winged upon her nest. The outcast came, the sinners gathered round that tender flame. The demons, by the other sterner gods, rejected from their luminous abodes, gathered around the refuge of the lost, soft smiling on that wild and grisly host. All who were refugeless, wretched, unloved, the wicked and the good together moved naturally to him, the asylum sweet, and found their heaven at their master's feet. The vision changed, and in his place there stood a terror red as lightning or as blood. His fierce right hand a javelin advanced, and as he shook it, earthquake, reeling, danced across the hemisphere. Ruin and plague rained out of heaven. Disaster swift and vague threatened, a marching multitude of ills. His foot strode forward to oppress the hills, and at the vision of his burning eyes, the hearts of men grew faint with dread surmise of sin and punishment. Their crowd was loud, O master of the storm wind and the cloud, spare, Rudra, spare. Show us that other form auspicious, not incarnate wrath and storm. The god of wrath, the god of love are one, nor least he loves when most he smites. Alone who rises above fear and plays with grief, defeat and death, inherits full relief from blindness and beholds the single form, love masking terror, peace supporting storm. The friend of man helps him with life and death until he knows. Then freed from mortal breath, he feels the joy of the immortal play. Grief, pain, resentment, terror pass away. He too grows Rudra, fierce, august, and dire, and Shiva, sweet fulfiller of desire.
There's a lot of difference with the PDF version with what you read.
Oh, is it? I see. Interesting. This is an early edition. This is the 1972 edition that I read from.
We actually have just one more paragraph left in this chapter.
So we should,
yeah, let's read.
Keka, would you like to read?
Sure. We see then that there are three terms of the one existence, transcendent, universal, and individual, and that each of these always contains, secretly or overtly, the two others. The transcendent possesses itself always and controls the other two as the basis of its own temporal possibilities. That is the divine, the eternal, all-possessing God consciousness, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, which informs, embraces, governs, all existences. The human being is here on earth, the highest power of the third term, the individual. For he alone can work out at its critical turning point that movement of self-manifestation which appears to us as the involution and evolution of the divine consciousness between the two terms of the ignorance and the knowledge. The power of the individual to possess in his consciousness by self-knowledge his unity with the transcendent and the universal, with the one being and all beings, and to live in that knowledge and transform his life by it, is that which makes the working out of the divine self-manifestation through the individual possible. And the arrival of the individual, not in one but in all, and the divine life, is the sole conceivable object of the movement. The existence of the individual is not an error in some self of the absolute, which that self afterwards discovers. For it is impossible that the absolute self-awareness or anything that is one with it should be ignorant of its own truth and its own capacities and betrayed by that ignorance either into a false idea of itself which it has to correct or an impossible venture which it has to renounce. Neither is the individual existence a subordinate circumstance in a divine play or lila, a play which consists in a continual revolution through unending cycles of pleasure and suffering without any higher hope in the lila itself or any issue from it except the occasional escape of a few from time to time out of their bondage to this ignorance. We might be compelled to hold that ruthless and disastrous view of God's workings if man had no power of self-transcendence or no power of transforming by self-knowledge the conditions of the play nearer and nearer to the truth of the divine delight. In that power lies the justification of individual existence. The individual and the universal unfolding in themselves the divine light, power, joy of transcendent Satchidananda, always manifest above them, always secret behind their surface appearances. This is the secret intention, the ultimate significance of the divine play, the lila. But it is in themselves, in their transformation, but also their persistence and perfect relations, not in their self-annihilation, that must be unfolded. Otherwise, there would be no reason for their ever having existed. The possibility of the divine's unfolding in the individual is the secret of the enigma. His presence there and this intention of self-unfolding, the key to the world of knowledge ignorance.
So we find here that concludes not only by talking about the coexistence of these three terms, but by giving the greatest place, at least in our experience of things, to the individual. And he does this because he points out particularly the human individual in this evolution of the knowledge out of the ignorance depends on the individual to achieve that coexistence. And it is in the many, not only in the single individual, but in the whole species, that such a coexistence must be experienced. The bridge must be built in the consciousness of individuals that then make the cosmos live in a new set of relations and form the fulfillment of its possibilities. So this is how Sri Aurobindo kind of shows the place of the human, the eternal and the individual. And the individual, not certain schools have seen the individual as a nobody, something that needs to be wiped out from the cosmos, or something that can only find its truth in the absolute, in which it no longer has any independent existence. But Sri Aurobindo takes a stand in that sense, closer to the Indian school of Vishishtadvaita, which says that the souls are eternal, nitya. They can never be destroyed. And even those beings who, as in Advaita Vedanta or Buddhism, claim that their souls exist no more in some moksha in which they have drowned themselves in the supreme infinite, they say that then too, that those very souls are only in a quiescent state, and by the will of the divine, they may return at any point. They may be made to return at any point into the manifestation. So this power given to the self-existence of the absolute as the individual in a evolutionary cosmos where it can play the central role in reversing the turning point and letting the Purusha take the lead over the Prakriti. Okay. So that is really the power by which ignorant cosmos can transform itself. And that's why he's that very powerful line in this paragraph where he's talking about the human as being the turning point. The human being is here on earth the highest power of the third term, the individual, for he alone can work out at its critical turning point that movement of self-manifestation which appears to us as the involution and evolution of the divine consciousness between the two terms of the ignorance and the knowledge. We lie at the cusp between the ignorance and the knowledge, and it is by the human will that this cusp has to be crossed, this bridge has to be crossed, and the power of knowledge brought in to transform the ignorance. And this is the kind of fulfillment of this entire system, of the Trinitarian system, one may say. So it's quite interesting that in Sri Aurobindo, in a way, is continuing the tradition of humanism which starts us off in the journey of our modern era, from the Renaissance, in fact, by claiming that the human being is the center of the cosmos, and puts into the background the idea of a Christian God. So this idea of the human being at the center of the cosmos, fielded by the Renaissance as the power of reason, has led us into our modern world. But Sri Aurobindo does not throw that out or say that the human being needs to wipe itself out into the absolute and allow the universal consciousness to do whatever it's doing. It's wiser than us. He pushes even further and redefines the human in terms of a will to transcendence that ultimately allows us to transform the cosmos rather than to allow it to overcome us and continue in its own wisdom. It's as if he points out that the transcendent wisdom, even superior to the wisdom of the cosmos, exists in every individual and invites the individual to deploy it to transform the cosmos and its bounded laws.
Devashish, at another point, you were talking about somehow the evolution of Prakriti, creating forms that the Purusha could then inhabit as a way for the cosmos to evolve. Is that involved in what you're talking about now?
Yeah, absolutely, Margaret. I completely agree. I think that is also involved, and that's why it means something when he says the human being is at that point, because the human being is a prakritic form. Okay. And so this prakritic form has arrived or appeared through the evolution of consciousness in this ignorance. But each one of these prakritic forms allows the possibility of housing certain powers of the Purusha. The Purusha can be more of itself given the prakritic form in which it can inhabit. So in the human prakritic form, Purusha becomes psychic being, which is not possible before that. And psychic being is essentially the divine soul that you know, integrates those powers of the divine, which can ultimately fulfill themselves in a creature. You know, it is the autopoetic tendency that finds something that can actually a creature that can actually not only survive through the species but survive as an individual. See, so this is the way in which this particular play of Prakriti and Purusha proceeds. And so beyond that, the prakritic vessels to be presented will be the self-presentations of Purusha. So because it will no longer be the bound, it will be as if the creative power of the one is brought to bear on the codes of the context, of the cosmic context, releasing them for new possibilities. Even at the material level, this seems to be happening. Our knowledge seems to be entering into, the understanding of fundamentals to such a degree, whether at the level of life or the level of matter, to such a degree that it is possible to uncode the codes and to recode them in new ways. The human being may not remain a human being. We are already, open to sort of becoming hybrid entities through spliced materials of a variety of kinds, including, artificial or machine, elements. So this is a prakritic adaptation to the pressure of a new evolution of Purusha that is necessary, and that is the invitation that he's talking about in the individual and in the collective.
Thank you.
Also, just to add another, angle on that question of Prakriti's providing vessels for the new manifestations of Purusha. Prakriti also evolves at the collective level. So, the entire evolution of human unity that Sri Aurobindo outlines in the ideal of human unity is a collective evolution of Prakriti at the human level. Because we may say that the human Prakriti, the Prakritic possibilities of the human are bounded as a species, but the collective possibilities are continuing to unfold what we can do as a people. And that has reached a certain stage of universality. We have reached a certain state of universality in our reason and in our knowledge. That is, one may say, knocking on the doors of a universal consciousness, calling on the Purusha of that plane to descend into the collective and the individual. So, in a sense, this is one of the reasons that it is more and more possible to open to the Shakti descending from above. Because humanity, not only at the individual level, but at the collective level, has evolved to that point in its mental development that the thousand-petal lotus above is accessible to a greater degree, is stirring from above, one may say.
Debashish, it seems like in the nick of time, since the world has so many challenges right now.
Yeah, that's the other side. I mean, the challenges are enormous. I mean, we are ending this year with challenges all around us. You know, climate challenges, challenges of culture, and very, very difficult challenges ahead of us.
I'm going to have to sign off. Thank you, Debashish.
Yeah, even if it's 9:40, perhaps this is fine. On the other hand, given it's the last paragraph, and we'll probably start the next one next time, Debashish, do you want to close out, or shall we stop here? Or
sorry, wasn't that the last paragraph we read? Was there another paragraph?
No, there isn't. So I was wondering.
Okay.
If you have any.
I think we can stop here and just continue next time.
Okay, so then I'll stop the call and upload the audio at some point. We'll continue next time.
Sure.
And will we be starting the next chapter then?
Yes, we'll be starting the next chapter. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Deb.
Okay,
thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. See you all again next time.
Bye, everybody.